And I think Sean was going to take us, it's agenda reference 37, and Sean was going to take us through it.
Great, thanks Ian. So TRG paper 37 summarizes the previous TRG discussion on two questions related to the scope of the guidance on consideration payable to a customer. It also presents two views related to the timing of recognition of consideration payable to a customer. Because of the, we were not able to have a joint discussion last time due to the technology issues, questions one and two are being brought back to the TRG to just make sure that the paper appropriately summarizes the views of TRG members. To briefly recap, question one addresses what payments to a customer are in the scope of the consideration payable to a customer guidance. TRG members had mixed views about whether the standard required application of view A or view B. However, they agreed that a reasonable application of either approach should result in similar financial reporting outcomes in most circumstances. Question two addressed who are considered the entity's customers. Most TRG members supported view B. That view is also consistent with additional outreach that the staff has performed subsequent to the last TRG meeting in context to the research that's being performed for the principal versus agent guidance that Kristen updated us on. Under view B, an entity would first identify its customers that result in the entity recognizing revenue, making sure it also includes entities that are in the distribution chain. In addition, an entity that is acting as an agent might view both the principal and the end customer of the principal as its customers. With that, I'd like to turn it over to the TRG to see if there's any concerns around the summary of the discussion on questions one and two, and if there's anything incremental that should be added for the minutes associated with those issues.
Okay.
Questions, comments?
This was discussed at the last meeting. We're not doing in-depth discussion
on
again.
On issues one and two.
Okay. So issue one, anybody in London got comments on question one? Brian.
I don't disagree with the minutes. I just thought the single most important sentence of the write-up on question one was the one at the end of paragraph five, that we thought that reasonable application should result in similar financial reporting outcomes. It seemed that some people were in a version of view A, some people were in a version of view B, but everybody kind of expected to meet in the middle. So for me, the key point is at the end of paragraph five.
And I think Sean sort of emphasised that a bit in his lead-in as well. Anybody else got comments on that? Are you happy with that conclusion? So A or B should lead to a similar result. What about question two? Any comments, Tony?
Just one comment. Again, I'm broadly comfortable with the minutes. I just noticed that paragraph 9 uses the word diversity a couple of times, and I just thought it's important to emphasize that view B might lead you to diversity when there are different circumstances, but I wouldn't want to interpret that as meaning that you get different answers in the same set of circumstances. So the differences in outcome will reflect differences in circumstances.
And you think appropriate?
Yes.
Yes. Anybody else to comment? Generally happy. So we'll go back to Norwalk.
Scott? Just wanted to bring up one more thing that I think companies may think of differently. If you go to Appendix A, the illustration of the transaction there, I think some of the companies in the marketing agent space here don't even think they have consideration payable to anybody to account for, because all the marketing agent ever did was collect 50 and remit 40. And we've sort of made up a payment of 5, but in fact, in this situation, the marketing agent never charged anybody the 5. So they didn't collect 5 and give it back to someone else. They never collected it in the first place. So I think in some cases, the entity in the marketing agent situation doesn't even think they have any consideration payable to account for.
Other observations, questions? Mark?
Yeah, I think I agree with whoever mentioned it over in London that it seems like question one, the key is that there's no, you don't need to start with every payment that's out there that's made to your customer. You look at the payments that are somehow linked, and you have to identify any that are potentially linked, and I think a reasonable application would get to that. On question two, I'm a bit confused on, are we saying it's view A unless there's something specific that's linking it? I looked at paragraph 10 specifically, and I think what I'm hearing that say is the payment to a customer's customer would be if somehow they're contractually linked, similar to the answer in question one. So if you look at the example that Scott was pointing to, if you give, if you're a travel agent and you run a promotion and you give $100 off the next trip, if somehow it's linked to a specific airline or a specific hotel, then that would somehow be a reduction of revenue. But if it's not, you would show that as marketing expense, and unless I'm missing something. But I didn't really get a clear answer in question two from this paper. Is the appendix somehow suggesting that every payment to a customer's customer is going to be a reduction of revenue?
No. What we were trying to get across in paragraph 10 is what the appendix is trying to illustrate, and then I'll come back to paragraph 10, is some folks are going to consider that both the merchant and the merchants and customer are their customers, and there's going to be diversity in whether or not they view both or just the merchant as their customer. However, paragraph 10 is saying, regardless of your view of how you think about it, if your contract with the merchant specifically says that you're going to be making payments to the merchant and customer, you have to consider that, those payments, no matter what. So that's the point we're trying to make with
if
paragraph
it doesn't?
10. What's that?
In my example where I'm a travel agent, I run a huge travel agent, and I run a promotion, and I say your next trip is $100 off. It's not linked to Delta. It's not linked to United. It's not linked to Marriott or whoever I'm getting my commission from. That wouldn't be linked, right?
If it's not, it's not contractual, no. But then what you're saying is there's diversity, and the TRG members were okay with that.
Sean, is it fair to say that what we heard from the TRG members is that view A is the minimum, and then there are some companies that think they have more than one customer? And for those companies that think they have more than one customer in an arrangement, then they might be in view B because of the fact that they view two parties in the transaction as being their customer.
Yeah,
but A would be the minimum.
That's a good way to think about it.
Anyone else here? Ian, I think on to issue three.
Okay, should have just sum up briefly on that one. I think we reached agreement on question one, and as was pointed out, views A or B should result in similar financial reporting outcomes, so we're not too concerned. And I think the question on paragraph 10 and question two was reasonably well covered, and it's a matter of who you consider your customer to be, I think, that makes the difference. Are you happy with that, Jim?
Okay, so moving on to question three in the paper. This gets into the timing guidance on consideration payable to a customer, and how does that reconcile with the overall principle about estimating variable consideration. There have been two views that have been put forth. Those that hold view A think that the guidance on estimating variable consideration and the specific timing guidance on recognizing consideration payable to a customer can be reconciled because not all consideration payable to a customer is variable consideration. Those with that view, though, acknowledge that the specific guidance on consideration payable to a customer would not apply to as many transactions as it does under existing GAAP, U.S. GAAP. This is a U.S. only issue. The staff thinks that acknowledgement is very important, a very important aspect of view A, and is consistent with case A in example 23 in the new revenue standard. in that example, which is also mentioned in the paper, based on past practices and to encourage sales through the distribution chain, the entity anticipates at contract inception that it will grant a price concession to the customer, and as a result, the consideration is variable. That price concession is consideration payable to a customer. However, in that example, the entity reduces the amount of revenue recognized for the expected price concession because the entity has intention, based on its past experience when entering into the contract, to offer the price concession. It does not wait until it actually communicates that price concession. Those that hold view B think the guidance on estimating variable consideration and the latter of guidance is not consistent. Those with that view think that the variable consideration guidance would require recognition of consideration payable to a customer when revenue is recognized, as opposed to, in certain circumstances, waiting until the consideration has been communicated to the customer. Those with view B that think that follow view B think the later of guidance should be deleted from the standard to resolve the inconsistency. With that, I'll turn it over to the TRG members for a discussion of the two views on question three.
Any comments at the London end? No?
To me, it seems clear reading the standard that there is a difference. So there's a difference which is acknowledged in paper 37, I think it's in paragraph 16. As to whether that's an inconsistency or a difference, I guess that comes down to whether this was an intentional difference. Some of the people I've spoken to think it is just an inconsistency because there doesn't seem to be any intention behind it. Others think they can see some intention behind it. But I guess from the point of view of standard setting, was there a reason why they were different?
Sean, you want to comment?
And I think that gets at the point. I mean, that's really, I guess, from you guys' perspective, is we've tried to reconcile it, the staff paper from last time. You know, personally, I think you can reconcile that there are certain circumstances when you would use the consideration payable to a customer guidance and other circumstances when you would not, but acknowledge that that's not a consensus view.
Does that satisfy you?
Yep.
Any other comments? Brian?
Again, this my take on this is that there are many circumstances in which the guidance can be reconciled, but similar to Phil, I think there is a difference that will arise in perhaps relatively limited circumstances. I think the circumstances are limited because the later of guidance can include references to implied promises. So it seems that the circumstances in which I find it difficult to reconcile the guidance is where the entity and the customer have a different expectation as to whether or not a price concession is going to be granted. So in lots of cases, entities and our customers may have a similar expectation, in which case the difference reconciles itself. I'm not sure how important or how many circumstances there are in which there will be an irreconcilable difference, but at least in theory, I do see the two bits of guidance as saying different things in some circumstances.
Okay, Tony?
Much the same. I also think that the guidance in some circumstances is saying two different things, because I think the idea of the definition of the transaction price requires an entity to take into account its expectations and intent, looking at it from the perspective of the entity. I think the later of guidance, as Brian says, takes into account the customer's expectations, and I think there might be circumstances in which those two things are not necessarily aligned. So like Brian and Phil, I can see how the guidance can be reconciled in a lot of circumstances where there is a shared expectation, but that there are probably circumstances where an entity has an intent or an expectation and there is no implied promise at that stage, in which case I think the two pieces of the guidance could send you in different directions. Now, I don't know how often that's going to happen, that my initial reaction is I would probably be reluctant to go changing the standard in respect of it. Just accept that there is a difference there. And in a fairly narrow set of circumstances might give rise to a different answer.
Although, Tony, I think to some degree it depends a little. I understand what you're saying, but it also depends exactly how you interpret the words around variable consideration in paragraph 52 and about how much of a mutual understanding you'd need between two parties before you consider there to be a feature in the contractual consideration.
I think it does, Henry. I think there's a there's always going to be an element of judgment about the extent to which there is an implied promise and therefore there is a shared expectation. I just think that the way that the two pieces of the literature are written,
yeah,
you could end up in a circumstance where the entity might have an expectation for whatever reason and the customer doesn't, and it could lead you to a different answer.
So just commenting specifically on that, I mean, Henry, I guess if the consideration is variable because of paragraph 52A, then that directly reconciles, and the issue, I think, is relationship between 52B and the later of guidance.
Yes.
But am I hearing both of you say this is a possible outcome, doesn't look very probable, and not something you'd take drastic action to avoid? Am I pushing you too far?
I don't know how often it's going to come up in practice, Ian, and I, like I said, I'm not sure I would advocate changing the standard for it, but I do think, I can't really comment on exactly how often it's going to come up and until we've seen it applied in anger.
Similarly, I have no survey data, but anecdotally I have not been asked the question except in connection with these TRG discussions.
Okay. Andrew?
Thanks, Ian. We'd really echo what's already been said. In terms of how often it comes up, it's not a question that's come across my desk. Now, whether it will at some point, I don't know, because we're still in relatively early stages. One of the other questions I did ask myself, though, was if I look at the effect of the way the standard's articulated at the moment, do I feel like I'm in a reasonably comfortable place in terms of the answer that pops out at the end? And I think the way it's articulated at the moment puts a reasonably substantial hurdle in place. If you've got a vendor that's saying, I expect to give a discount, and I would prefer to have that reasonably high hurdle maintained, otherwise you get into a difficult judgment space of just how much of an expectation do you have to have. So coming back to the question of, do I think something is needing to be done to the standard, I don't.
I mean, this is not the only area of accounting where we have to make those sort of balanced judgments, I would think. Jane?
As a user, I mean, how much transparency is there over price concessions, payments to customers, and is there an overlap with other regulation, like anti-bribery regulation? For instance,
I mean, there certainly could be disclosure provided around the concession arrangements, because there are disclosures around variable consideration arrangements, and obviously there are going to be disclosures around the judgments involved in here. You know, when they really have real impact and have a real effect. So there's, you get caught by some of the disclosure requirements, you'd at least have to think about them. I'm not sure I can comment on your specifically on your second.
Is there is vendor financing disclosures on that captured by other standards? Vendor financing purchases of its goods by the customer. Do we get transparent? Do we presumably that's caught by other standards? Is it? I'm just thinking of the sort of things
right.
that we would be concerned about.
A kind of different topic, because I think if you have vendor financing, you have an interest component in the sale price that must be unbundled.
Okay, yeah.
But here we're talking about payment going both ways.
Okay. Further comments? Over to you, Jim.
Questions or comments here? Allison?
I was just going to comment that I do think that there will be situations, certainly when you see an entity apply paragraph 32-27, especially circumstances that happen right after the reporting date. So you may have transferred a good or service to a customer, recognized the revenue for that, and that there may then, subsequent to the reporting date, be an amount of consideration that's being paid to the customer that has not been reflected in the revenue that was recognized when the good or service was transferred. And so I think in those situations, based on the conflict that we've identified in the guidance, it puts pressure on the existence of any evidence that someone might have needed to identify prior to the balance sheet date. So I think that that's just the reality. And it may not happen all that frequently, but in the situations when it does arise, it just puts a lot of pressure on it, because the financial reporting outcome of just applying 3227 is that you're over-recognizing revenue in one reporting period and then taking a reduction in a subsequent period. And I know that that oftentimes, you know, creates audit risk for sure.
This is, I guess, narrower than current GAAP. I mean, how do you handle that today? Because certainly that's required under U.S. GAAP today, the later of guidance.
Sure, the later of guidance is required today, but because that's a requirement across the board, there is no principle in the standards that we apply today to be estimating variable amounts of revenue before a discount like this would be
communicated. Although I think some in practice do, based on having a history of concession.
From my experience, companies really do have very specific procedures in place to be applying the paragraph, the guidance that exists today for the later of.
Scott?
Originally, when this issue came up, and I had thought about it before we talked about it at the TRG, I had concluded that I had to reconcile the two pieces of guidance, and therefore I thought I had figured out how they worked. 32.7b says other facts and circumstances indicate the entity's intention when entering into the contract is to offer a price concession. So I thought what it was telling me was that at contract inception, you think about whether the customer has an intention, or whether, excuse me, the seller has an intention to offer a discount, and if so, you take that into account. But if you pass through that when entering into the contract, then you default to the later of guidance. In other words, if you didn't have an intention when entering into the contract, but one was formed later, well, you don't take it into account when you form that intention, because you have to wait until you actually make the offer. That's how I had reconciled it, because I thought I had to reconcile it. Now, if that's not the way it's supposed to work, then I think we need some clarification.
I think I'm maybe saying similar to what Scott said there, and it goes back to paragraph 10, and maybe that notion of somehow there's, and it's the definition of what the contract is. Does the contract include these items? I think when we read this, or when I read this, I just think the ladder of guidance, I think, is applicable to coupon accounting, obviously, and I don't know what the answer is here. I think what this is saying is if you have a history of issuing coupons, then that would be, you can't wait until the coupons drop like you do today. I think it's sort of redefining when you have a liability for that coupon drop. But I guess if you could clarify, if I'm a large consumer products manufacturer and I issue coupons all the time, I would think if you bring in the notion of paragraph 10, if I'm issuing a coupon for a specific customer, that would be different than if I'm just broadly issuing a coupon that you can take anywhere. But when I hear things like it's a high hurdle, well, I've had a history of issuing coupons, so it's pretty clear I'm going to issue coupons all throughout the year. Do I need to estimate those when I sell, or do I wait until I drop the coupon? I don't know if we have a specific answer to that, but if that's clarified, I think it makes it, you know, easier for me to at least apply the guidance in here. So I mean, the way I read all this, I would say, unless I'm dropping a coupon specifically for a particular retailer, in other words, take this coupon into that retailer, that would be the ladder of guidance. And if I'm misinterpreting that, you know, let me know.
Brett?
I think the ladder of guidance, it's maybe consistent with what Allison was saying, the ladder of guidance under today's GAAP doesn't necessarily introduce this notion of an implied practice, which I think is a very important distinction in the new standard, which I guess in our mind helps narrow the circumstances under which the potential inconsistency would really be a problem, as long as people are, you know, applying that rigorously. Because I think today, typically with coupon drops and whatnot, I think people do focus on when did it happen. You know, it happened post balance sheet date, then I'm going to account for it in that period. And whereas I think the standard is telling me for consideration payable to a customer, I have to consider that implied practice, and if that already exists, then I'm. So the tension point will be around when is there an implied practice? You know, is this coupon program different than other ones I've done? Let's say. So I think there's like an inconsistency. I think I've said this before, but I think it's, if I have a price concession just and I sold something to a customer and now based on revised expectations, even after the inception of the contract, but before it's completed, turns out that I expect to collect less from that customer. So I'm going to give them a price concession, and they've come and asked me for it. I may not have communicated a final decision to the customer, but if my intentions have changed, then I'm going to reflect that in my accounting. So I think there's pressure on, well, what does it mean to make a promise to a customer? Is that how definitive does that promise have to be made? And, you know, can it just be a verbal promise? Does the board have to approve it and all that sort of stuff? But I guess what I'm saying, as long as people, in my mind, as long as we're With a clean sheet of paper, my preference would have been not to have a ladder of guidance in the standard, because I think it does feel inconsistent with the sort of the basic principle in the standard about which is expectations based. But if people are, you know, if they're careful about how they think about implied practices, I don't think it will be a wide spectrum of transactions where it would be applicable.
Yeah, I think as a practical matter, I think people will keep in mind the broad principle, which is the amount expected to be entitled. If you keep that in mind, then to like Brad and Allison's point, I think that's going to drive people to, the onus is going to be on the preparer to demonstrate there was not variable consideration, and somehow through some miracle of circumstances, they got to this consideration payable to a customer. Later of guidance.
Others here? Ian?
Okay. Well, I think in question three, I think there was a fair consensus that it's probably fairly narrow circumstances that you would have any conflict, in that if you keep the principle in mind, the last speaker I think, and work through it, that you'll get to the answer, and that probably some suggested perhaps a clarification. I don't think anybody suggested a change in the standard, so I think we can move on from there.